for Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Basketball fans are likely to enjoy the next few minutes as we explore a really interesting, even provocative book called Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. It is the contention of the author of this book, Jake Fisher, there was, particularly for a time, and maybe there are still pockets of the NBA in which there is still incentive to lose. That is, by achieving success at losing, a given team perhaps sets themselves up for dramatic future improvement because of the way in which they're going to be able to bring in much higher levels of talent into the organization. It's something that theoretically has probably been possible for a long time, but became even more prevalent in part because of certain situations or conditions, but also because of certain people who came onto the scene in the NBA and wanted to capitalize on the situation in a sense. Jake Fisher, who is a basketball journalist who has written for Sports Illustrated, Slam Magazine, and much more, did literally hundreds of interviews with players and coaches and people from the front office to try to get some insight into what was going on and the cost to the overall game with this practice. The book, again, titled Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever, published by Triumph Books. And Jake Fisher, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me. That was a very nice introduction. I'm excited to dive in.
Great. Ahead of us talking about your book, I wonder if you could just say a word about your own relationship to the game. Obviously, it is something into which you've really poured your professional energies and talents. Do you come at this as someone who used to play the game and loved it from, in a sense, the court, or has your love of basketball mostly been from the stands, so to speak?
Yeah, I definitely grew up playing. I played pretty competitively throughout high school. I probably could have played, I don't want to be that guy, but I probably could have played lower level college, but I realized pretty early, probably in middle school, that I wanted to use basketball as a way to make a career by writing and analyzing the game and telling stories more so than playing. I knew I probably wasn't going to be 6'5" and being able to dunk. So, you know, as a nice 6-foot Jewish boy from South Jersey, I figured the easier opportunity would be to pivot into the writing space. And you know, it's pretty amazing that, you know, flash forward, I'm only 27 and 8 years into my career, but, you know, here we are with a published book, and I'm pretty proud of it.
Yeah. I wonder if you could just say something about the game of basketball itself and what makes it a wonderful sport to cover and to write about.
I think basketball is the ultimate team game, being that, and it's why tanking ultimately, I think, is more prevalent in the NBA than in other sports as well, being that every single player has the opportunity to play both sides of the ball and play the entire game. And we just don't see that in any other team function. I think it's the ultimate game of chemistry and teamwork and collective progress towards a common goal, and, you know, sacrifice, you know, running the floor really hard but not getting the pass on the fast break sometimes opens up a lane for somebody on the other side of the court. Those types of little things are stuff that I've always really been pretty much in love with, to be honest with you.
It's interesting as you describe that, it makes me realize that, you know, sometimes you hear the term gladiator to describe a football player, you know, gladiators on the gridiron. But of course, in a football game, not to minimize the challenge of the game, you at least typically have half your team on the field at any one time and the other half on the sideline. And that's not even figuring in special teams and those not playing at all for whatever reason. Whereas in basketball, they really are gladiators because there is this relentlessness. And although, of course, players come on and off the court from time to time, you basically have that team out there for the full duration of the conflict at hand. And I'd never really stopped to think about it, but there really isn't another sport, a team sport, that has that particular dynamic to it.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I think that's a testament to why, you know, all these analytical-minded executives that came to power from 2012 to 2016 that we cover in my book, they all kind of realized throughout the history of the NBA, championships, you know, championship teams, they're all typically comprised with multiple all-stars who dominate both sides of the court. And I think that's why there's been a big emphasis being placed on getting those guys at the top of the draft, because, you know, LeBron James, for example, can make 8 out of 10 finals. That's as much a testament to himself and his greatness as it is how one singular entity and one singular talent can lift up an entire basketball team.
So your title or subtitle refers to the NBA's tanking era. And we should probably first of all talk about the particular moment in time that we're talking about here with this so-called tanking era, when it seemed like there was a handful of teams that seemed to be going out of their way to lose, that were in effect engineering losing to a degree that was going to serve their long-range purposes. Explain to our listeners when we are talking about and what teams in effect drew suspicion, your suspicion, and probably those of others as well.
I'd say definitely those of others as well. I think that the period that we're talking about starts in 2012. Obviously, Sam Hinkie in Philadelphia and their process is kind of the poster child for this, but, you know, Rob Hennigan was hired by the Orlando Magic in 2012 from the Oklahoma City Thunder after the Thunder, behind their own analytical-minded executive, Sam Presti, you know, they drafted KD and Russell Westbrook and James Harden 3 straight years from 2007 to 2009, and they made the finals right away in 2012. And the Magic poached Rob Hennigan, another, you know, acolyte of that, you know, more numbers-based team-building strategy. And, you know, Hennigan immediately started a rebuild in Orlando by trading Dwight Howard to the Lakers. And across the aisle, the Suns trade Steve Nash away to the Lakers as well, and flash forward a year later, Phoenix hires Ryan McDonough, another analytically minded executive. That's when Sam Hinkie comes into power in Philly in May 2013 as well. And Sacramento hired Pete D'Alessandro, who was a former lawyer, and the Cleveland Cavaliers empowered David Griffin, who actually built the Suns analytics database back during their hierarchy with Steve Nash. And, you know, coincidentally, the Miami Heat were running the league at that time as well. And we mentioned LeBron earlier. The Heat were comprised of Dwayne Wade, who they drafted very high in 2003, was considered to be one of the best drafts of all time. And then he lured LeBron and Chris Bosh to join him in free agency to create their title team. at that same, you know, time of history. And coincidentally, even further, the 2014 draft was considered to be the best class since 2003. So all these executives, Rob Hennigan in Orlando, Sam Hinkie in Philadelphia, Ryan McDonough in Phoenix, and a bunch more that we've already discussed, they all thought at the same time, you know, we're not going to beat Miami anyway, and our only chance to beat them in the future is to be bad on purpose, because the best range to get access to players who have similar talents to LeBron, Wade, and Bosh is to draft them where those guys were drafted, in the top five. And the best way to do so under the NBA's current situation was to have your worst record as possible and therefore be rewarded with the highest number of lottery balls that then determine the order of the draft every May.
Let's take a moment to talk about these particular gentlemen who you know, kind of figured at the very heart of this, and you've already mentioned them, Mr. Hinkie and Mr. Hennigan and Mr. D'Alessandro. You tell us in the introduction to the book that one thing that these guys had in common is that they were not former players with an innate feel for the game. These men were, frankly, nerds. Tell us more about the way in which these guys were more nerds than basketball guys in the more sort of common sense of the word, and what a difference that made in terms of their approach to their respective teams' challenges.
Now, pretty much all these guys played athletics in some form in their careers. I mean, Hennigan was, he might still be, the all-time leading scorer in Emerson College's Division III basketball team. And Sam Hinkie was, I believe, a three-sport athlete in high school. But none of these players, or none of these executives played in the league. And for decades, you know, think about the Red Auerbach Celtics, right, where you'd have your team and you would win and play out your career, and then a lot of those players would come and be coaches and be front office executives, and the NBA really was this lifelong fraternity. Once you were in it as a player, you had a lot of opportunities to be a coach and an executive for the rest of your career. But around the turn of the 2010s into from the 2000s into the 2010s, there really was a wave of these outsiders who didn't play but started to reflect how their numbers and their data analysis could really benefit and boost the traditional basketball minds, and to show this empirical evidence to back up or reject certain notions that the traditional basketball thinker saw from their eye test. And it's still continuing to be a rift throughout the NBA. We still hear to this day about coaches being prickly when an analytics staffer gives them some type of detail or information or intel that's contradictory to what the coach wants to do. And that can be from lineup adjustments to overall playing strategy. And I think that is partially why this tanking era became so polarizing and so newsworthy, is that a lot of people, these basketball lifers, were upset that these newer age nerds who look like guys who could have worked on Wall Street, They wore suits and glasses. They didn't wear basketball sweats. And I think that was partially why there was such an uproar about maximizing the rules that the NBA allows for teams to bottom out in order to be good in the future. There was this outcry from the traditional basketball cognoscenti of, we're here to win the game. We're not here to lose, even if there is long-term benefits. We want to put out a winner every single night.
We're speaking with Jake Fisher about his book, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. For us to understand this, it's important for us to understand the NBA draft lottery. I wonder if you could give us whatever you can of a sort of a long-range view of the NBA draft lottery, of how it has operated over the years, and did something happen to the way that the draft lottery was implemented that would have precipitated what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I think you flash back to 1984 when the Houston Rockets, they were seeing this big local product at Houston College by the name of Hakeem Olajuwon, and the Rockets did everything they could. They lost 16 of their last 21 games in the 1983-84 season to get into, at the end of the season back then, there was a coin flip between the worst team in the West and the worst team in the East to decide that number one selection. And there was a lot of outcry all the way back then that Houston gained the system to get Hakeem. And that was right when David Stern took over the league as commissioner. And he wanted to prevent that from happening again. And he instituted the first version of the lottery in 1985, which, as many people listening probably remember, that was the frozen envelope that brought Patrick Ewing to the New York Knicks. And from there, you know, it evolved over time to finally got the lottery ball situation in 1990. But through the late 1990s, they really did solidify this format where every May, teams were slotted with a number of ping pong ball combinations from descending order of record, and the worst team in the league had a 25% chance of that number one pick. There would be three lottery drawings, so they would draw 1 through 3, and then every single team would then be slated 4 through 14 that didn't win in their direct order. So even though the worst team in the league only had a 25% chance of winning that top pick, their percentages kept increasing as you went down the board to 2 and to 3, and they were guaranteed to pick no lower than 4. And that's the system that ultimately all these analytical-minded executives that we talked about, Sam Hinkie, Rob Hennigan, Ryan McDonough, that they wanted to play. They wanted to take their chances because in a really deep-loaded draft like the 2014 class, like the 2003 class, even if you don't get the number one pick, even if you don't get LeBron, you could still get Dwayne Wade or Carmelo Anthony or Chris Bosh. Or in 2014, you know, the thought at the time was Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker were supposed to be the next LeBron and Carmelo, but then you had Joel Embiid and Julius Randle, and there was an international prospect of mystery, Dante Exum from Australia, and Aaron Gordon was a super athletic guy from Arizona, and you had Marcus Smart, who came back to Oklahoma State as a sophomore. It was considered to be a 7-player class. So that if you could just get one of those guys, they'd be putting you on the path back towards contention. And I think just that tantalizing chance to have an opportunity to select them was, you know, all the juice and all the inspiration needed to play that lottery in 2014.
So we're talking about a point in time in which, at least in some ways, it would make sense for a losing team to lose as much as possible, that the more they lost, the more likely they were to reap some benefit when it came to the next draft. Is it as simple as that?
I wish it was, and I'm sure NBA executives wish it was too. I think that's why this strategy ultimately made for a book as well, being that all these teams doing it at the same time, they allowed for different case studies of the same abstract, and they all kind of, you know, any team building experience, whether you're tanking or whether you're just trying to rejigger some things and figure it out, It's unfortunately perilous, being that there are a ton of unforeseen variables that come into play. People can get injured. People can, you know, decide they don't want to play with a certain player and request a trade. But you're also, every team starts from a different starting point. The Boston Celtics factored into this equation the same exact time as these other teams we've been talking about. They traded Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce to the Brooklyn Nets during the 2013 draft, the same night that Sam Hinkie traded Jrue Holiday away from the Philadelphia 76ers to start that rebuild in earnest. And the Celtics they started from a point of trading away veteran all-stars and future Hall of Famers that were part of a championship team. That's going to get you more picks and allow more margin for error and more darts to throw at the dartboard over consecutive years. So if you miss on a guy in 2014, if you take a Dante Exum at number 5, that Australian point guard, that international man of mystery that the Utah Jazz did, I know Dante Exum isn't playing in the NBA right now. He did not turn into being the franchise pillar that the Jazz thought, but then they made strategic other selections and They had get Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert and some other great draft decisions and free agents and signings and trades, and the Jazz have the best record in the NBA this year versus the Orlando Magic. You know, they had as many opportunities to draft in the top five from 2013, 14, 15, 16. They had so many draft picks, and even still, you flash forward to 2021, this very trade deadline, the Magic are trading away all the players that they acquired over those years to start another rebuild in earnest, and they tanked again this year to try for this 2021 draft, which is ironically considered to be the best class since 2014. So it is it's not a direct path. If you do choose to do this, you have to be able to realize that you need to take a lot of different chances, and sometimes that means being worse and being bad for more than 1 year at a time.
In order for this to be accomplished, who has to be on board? I mean, it's obvious that you just can't have a general manager that believes this is the way to go. I mean, what sort of buy-in typically is there? I mean, is it all hands on deck, everybody in the front office? Do they need to be on the same page? And what about the players? Do they all need to be on the same page? Or is this something that is done in more subtle fashion where people who are part of the team in whatever respect, who would never, ever approve of such a thing, might unwittingly be part of it because it's being done in sort of subtle ways? How has this typically played out, and how did it play out in the teams that you examine in your book?
I think any decision at the top of a franchise ultimately comes down to ownership approval. So at the beginning of any strategy like this, it takes an executive, sometimes from them being hired, but also, you know, if you do make a pivot away from your contending team, like the Celtics did, for example, it takes ownership approval from the get-go, absolutely. And from there, I think the book is called Built to Lose for a reason. The players and the coaches, they never really truly go out on a consistent basis and try to punt games on purpose. What happens is the rosters are built to lose. So that can be accomplished in several different ways. It can be an executive like Sam Hinkie trading Drew Holiday away, or the Celtics trading KG and Paul Pierce. It starts with taking your best player, your best trade asset, if you will, and moving them to a different team in order to get back future draft picks, future draft capital that will potentially help you maybe move up higher in the draft or select another young player that could be a franchise-changing talent. But in the interim, when you send away your best players, you're intentionally dropping and lowering your team's overall talent level, which doesn't put those coaches and those players in position to actually win games and compete against the more talented teams. And we see an even more evolved edition of a strategy where teams can even start resting their veteran players and saying, you know, we want to develop our young guys. That's a very nice public relations cliche to basically say we want to put out our least talented and least experienced players right now. They will get better in the process. It may turn them into better players down the future who could become a veteran star for our team. I mean, look at Milwaukee. The Bucks, after they drafted Giannis Antetokounmpo in 2013, they had no intention of playing him that season, that 13-14 year. They wanted to be a playoff team. They thought Giannis would play in, back then it was called the D League at the time. But the Bucks had a lot of injuries, and sure enough, they realized their playoff team was not going to make the postseason, and they started playing Giannis. He played over 70 games that year, a kid who had really no competitive basketball experience compared to that level at all, and he got better through that experience. But at the same time, the Bucks obviously lost a lot of games, being that him and other rookie players like Chris Middleton and other young guys, they didn't have the actual ability at that time to realize talent to compete on a nightly basis, and therefore you can quote-unquote develop your players and put them into game situations and hopefully they'll improve. but in the process, you're also losing the game and maybe putting yourself in a position to get a worser record, to get more lottery balls, to give yourself a better chance to draft a teammate who could help Giannis become a playoff team and a contender down the road.
So in other words, this is, in a sense, front office tanking. That is where the tanking takes place. And it's an important distinction because, of course, I think most people, when they hear the word tanking, immediately imagine players intentionally tanking out on the court. That is not giving their all for whatever reason, not wanting to push themselves. I mean, making bad decisions on the court and intentionally losing. And while I think we're not talking about that being completely absent from this scenario, you are primarily talking about another kind of tanking in which, by and large, you have players playing their hearts out, but at such a disadvantage, thanks to the front office, that they are likely to be on the losing end. Is that a fair summation?
I think so. There are situations in the end of the regular season, typically in April, where we do see teams, you know, playing, you know, inexperienced players in different positions, or, you know, encouraging a player who isn't very talented at shooting the ball to take a lot of three-pointers and position themselves really to lose a couple of games down the stretch. But yes, overall, I do think it's a more systemic ideological concept and a strategy versus something that the players and the coaches actually do employ out on that battlefield, if you will.
We're speaking with Jake Fisher. We're talking about his book, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. This looks back at 2013-2014 primarily, and in the years that immediately followed, when we saw some teams in the NBA engaging in this kind of activity, which Jake Fisher would probably term as sort of administrative tanking in order to secure a better place, a better position in the subsequent draft lotteries in hopes of heading for greater success. Your book is built upon hundreds of interviews which you conducted. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested to know sort of the circumstances under which these interviews took place. And the people that you spoke to, were they aware of the purpose of these interviews? I only ask that because I wonder how one can secure such openness and honesty for a project like this. Did you have to be a little bit careful and perhaps veil to some extent the intention behind these interviews and what you were actually investigating?
Yeah, I talked to over 300 people for this book. Like you mentioned, players, agents, coaches, executives. A lot of the people I talked to, you know, at this point, I've been covering the NBA for about 8 years, and I think, you know, I'm pretty much one degree away, I would say, from contacting pretty much any figure around the league. I typically know somebody who knows somebody. So from there, I think I've developed a rapport with league people, knowing that, you know, I like to report and have honest conversations about interesting things around the NBA. And, you know, at a certain degree, yes, you do kind of have to say in an email to a PR director, you know, I'm working on a book about team building, not necessarily tanking, but when I would walk up to a player in the locker room or get somebody on the phone, and once that conversation started going, I mean, they knew. I mean, the people that are involved in these situations that are, you know, losing game after game after game, they know what's happening. They understand. You know, it's not a player's job to lose the game and help the executive. And a lot of these players were very candid with me. Evan Turner was a veteran player on the Sixers in 2013-14 who very much knew that Sam Hinkie had him on the trade block and was trying to move Evan to A, make his team less talented, and B, collect some draft capital to hopefully, like we talked about, restock the cupboard. And Evan told me fully and candidly that he went to Celtics head coach Brad Stevens on multiple occasions in the back hallway between the locker rooms, begging for Brad to trade for him and get him out of that situation, to put him in a winning environment. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these players, they're motivated by truly one thing, and I can't blame them for it. It's to put themselves in a position to play their best, to ultimately get paid their best. And when you're in a losing environment, you don't get paid very well. People get rewarded financially in the NBA for being part of a winning franchise. That's from players, coaches, and executives all above. But players can really you know, improve their bottom line by contributing. They can put the same exact numbers up for a 17-65 team that they do on a 65-17 win team, and that 65-17 win team, you know, that ends up, that performance ends up putting them in a different stratosphere for compensation. So I think there was definitely a little delicate balance of getting some people on the phone or addressing the topic altogether. But at the end of the day, people in the NBA aren't silly, and they know what was going on at that time period anyway.
It's so interesting to think about. We don't often think about the plight of an NBA player. I mean, even NBA players who are not superstars are, generally speaking, compensated pretty well. I mean, they're not paid like ditch diggers or folks at McDonald's. I mean, they are relatively well played for playing a wonderful game. But it's interesting to think about, I'll use the word plight, of a player who finds themselves on this kind of team, because it's exciting to win and it's debilitating to lose, especially when you feel like you're losing because of not just coming out on the losing end of an honest battle on the court, but you're losing because of so much being stacked against you. People, forces from your own team stacking things against you and making winning all but impossible. I mean, what do players have to say about being caught in that kind of frustrating scenario?
It's frustrating for the veteran players like Evan Turner, who have already established themselves and are wanting to put themselves in a position to get that next contract, or, you know, at a certain point, once players do pad their wallets and establish some generational wealth to help their families for generations to come, a lot of them do start to shift focus and want to win. But for younger players, those younger players that we've talked about who are suddenly getting more playing time to figure it out and to find their footing in the league, a lot of the times being in a tanking or rebuilding situation is very beneficial to them, and it allows them to actually start their career in earnest. So I think it depends on who you talk to. Yes, the veterans who are getting kind of screwed over can typically be those seasons as a whole lost year of their career. But for younger guys who are first getting an opportunity that they might not have even gotten elsewhere, because, you know, typically teams are trying to win games, they can view those situations as honestly like a manna from heaven and a blessing in disguise.
Interesting. So it depends a lot on where a player is in the arc of their career. If you're towards the end, you're not likely to be around to reap the benefits of such a strategy. But if you are a younger player, chances are perhaps that you will. One of the things that's really interesting about your book is that you explore some of the various and competing ideas on how to remake the draft lottery, on ways to reform it in ways that would perhaps make it more fair or more beneficial to a wider swath of teams and so on. And you paint a picture of various teams being at odds with one another. In other words, depending on, I suppose, what kind of team you are, the size of your market or whatever, you might have your own vested interests that might be very much at odds with the vested interests of a different sort of ball team. And that's one reason why reform of this has been so slow in coming. Can you say a word about that?
Yeah, I think the league has a referendum that they need to face, being that as much as team building and roster construction has been great to streamline a conversation with fans on social media and make this an 11-month news cycle where any team and any fan can Photoshop any player into their team's jersey, and there's a real likelihood that can happen. But when teams are losing games on purpose and there's all this concentration on the off season, I think that's played a factor in devaluing the regular season, and that's why we're seeing, you know, them change the lottery odds based on this tenure that we did. There's no longer a 25% chance for that worst team. The bottom three teams now have an even 14% chance, and they've instituted a play-in tournament at the end of the year to create two more opportunities for teams to get into the playoffs rather than incentivizing those teams to lose to improve their lottery positioning. And I think we're going to see them ultimately institute a mid-season tournament in the next couple of years to do so as well. So I think the NBA does have an issue at hand where their regular season product and their game-to-game product has taken a beating, and ratings are down based on, you know, I think a big factor of it is because of all this attention placed on the bigger picture and the roster construction and the team building conversations that we've had, you know, the last half hour.
Sam Hinkie began to draw more and more criticism, and you tell us at one point in your book that there were league voices suggesting that Sam Hinkie should be fined by the commissioner of the NBA for what you describe as brazen losing. Just describe the extent to which, in a sense, the most significant offenders in terms of deliberate losing were in trouble.
Well, the league is a business, like we just mentioned. And when the Philadelphia 76ers, who are the third winningest franchise of all time, when they're all of a sudden choosing to be one of the worst teams ever year after year after year, a lot of rival owners ended up not taking too kindly to that when, you know, they're coming into their arena and they can't sell tickets. And, you know, it takes off another marquee franchise to put on national TV schedules. And it was kind of being decried as a black eye on the league. And I think that's ultimately a big reason why Sam Hinkie was essentially pushed out of his role in Philadelphia, being that, you know, then his players, Joel Okafor, who they drafted number 3 in 2015, ends up getting in a publicized fight in Boston, and he has other run-ins with the police where a gun got pulled on him, and he was speeding over the Ben Franklin Bridge, and the Sixers, this team run by Sam Hinkie, who notoriously didn't speak publicly very often about his, you know, brazen losing, now all of a sudden his players are kind of being seen as running off the rails, and these young guys who aren't in a winning environment are kind of, you know, running around going crazy in the streets. That was kind of the angle. Obviously, that's a little bit hyperbolic, being that these were, especially Joel Okafor, 19-year-old kids mostly put in bad situations. But definitely that negative PR and that groundswell of negative attention ultimately played a big factor in Sam losing his job.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the things that is important in all of this is that this might seem to make all the sense in the world, but it is also a gamble that one, and it can be a terrible gamble, that one can, in a sense, set up a team to lose in order to improve its draft prospects, but that doesn't mean that player you select is going to be that golden ticket to greatness. There are a lot of things that can go wrong, and at what a cost.
It's perilous, being that, you know, the goal is to win titles down the line. And if you don't put yourself in a position to see that pot at the end of the rainbow, then, you know, you don't get a chance to actually reap the benefits of everything you've done. So it's a challenge, and it's a bitter pill for a lot of people to swallow, unfortunately, yes.
In your book, you quote Stan Van Gundy, Pistons head coach and president, saying, "I haven't heard anybody say this is good for the game. I just think a lot of people don't feel like they have a choice." And ahead of that, it says, "I don't think anybody out there thinks it's a desirable thing to be tanking." In other words, he's painting a scenario here of owners and perhaps coaches feeling like they are kind of painted into a corner by the system, and sometimes compelled to make as nasty a choice as this. Do you see much in the way of hope in terms of this situation improving? I mean, it perhaps has improved some from the particular seasons that you focus on, but clearly you believe that this is still an issue to some extent.
Yeah, this very year, Orlando traded 3 All-Stars away, All-Star caliber players away, to, you know, fumble their way down the standings. The Oklahoma City Thunder sent multiple players home for the second half of the year. The Detroit Pistons just waived Blake Griffin, who's a starter for the Brooklyn Nets right now in the playoffs. The Houston Rockets did the same thing with resting John Wall and allowing a young player named Kevin Porter Jr. to, you know, make his mistakes like we've talked about and develop his, you know, plan and his career. So I think we're seeing people do even more brazen efforts than Sam Hinkie ever did. And I think, you know, as long as the lottery remains, teams are always going to be tanking, being that their draft positioning will be directly related to their record.
Jake Fisher, writer for Sports Illustrated and Slam Magazine, is the author of Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever, published by Triumph Books. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's morning show, I'm going to be speaking with the co-authors of a very intriguing new book called The Plant-Based Athlete: A Game-Changing Approach to Peak Performance. This is a book that takes aim at some widespread myths about what kind of food athletes, competitive athletes, need to eat. We've all seen the scenario of football players right before the big game sitting down for steak dinners and the like. But it is the contention of Matt Frazier and Robert Cheek, along with many, many other experts, that a plant-based diet is of tremendous value to competitive athletes, especially if they want to compete at the highest level of their efficiency. The book makes reference to a number of different elite athletes who have changed their eating habits and seen spectacular results, from tennis players Serena and Venus Williams to NFL luminaries such as Derek Morgan, Cam Newton, and Tom Brady, to boxer Mike Tyson just ahead of his comeback, to famed track and field legend Carl Lewis, to tennis player Novak Djokovic, who just won the French Open at Roland Garros. All of these athletes and countless more have seen their abilities to excel at their sports improved dramatically as they adapted their diets to be plant-based. This book, The Plant-Based Athlete, explores the science behind why this choice makes such a difference. Matt Frazier is the founder and CEO of No Meat Athlete and author of the No Meat Athlete Cookbook, a marathoner and ultra runner who qualified for the Boston Marathon thanks to the help of a plant-based diet. And he's also the host of the No Meat Athlete podcast. Robert Cheek is the founder of Vegan Bodybuilding and is a 2-time natural bodybuilding champion and author of Shred It, a public speaker, and he has followed a plant-based diet for more than a quarter century. This book, The Plant-Based Athlete, A Game-Changing Approach to Peak Performance, is published by Harper One, a division of HarperCollins. One of the intriguing things about the two of you co-writing this book is that one of you is a marathoner, one of you is a bodybuilder, and so two very different kinds of athletes, but both experiencing the very same thing as have a whole host of professional athletes, namely the benefits of a plant-based diet. One of the main points of your book is that it matters the kind of choices that you make. I mean, just eating a plant-based diet is not necessarily going to give people the results that they want. What kind of choices does someone need to think about making in terms of exactly what their plant-based diet should consist of?
Thanks, Greg. Really appreciate that. Really what we're trying to communicate here with the plant-based athlete is that if you reach your calorie needs and if you eat a diversity of plant-based whole foods, you will reach all your protein goals. You will consume anti-inflammatory properties, antioxidants. You'll increase your energy, reduce inflammation, improve your recovery. And that's the name of the game. So you're right, Greg. It's about being mindful and about choosing the best types of foods. And then those happen to be leafy green vegetables, fruits, legumes, grains, and nuts and seeds, of course, for their benefits. And all of those recipes are found in the book as well. So you can create your own plant-based athlete diet.
One of the distinctions your book makes is between calorie density and nutrient density. And apparently this is a distinction that really matters when it comes to making some of these choices. Explain what the difference is between those two terms.
Sure. So I'll start with calorie density, and that has to do with basically the number of calories that a food provides for a given volume. So how many calories does it take to fill up your stomach with a certain food? Plant-based foods tend to be very low if they're whole plant-based foods, as you mentioned, as opposed to like the processed, you know, vegan junk foods, of which, of course, there still are plenty of those. But if you pick the whole foods, you don't pack that many calories when you fill up your stomach. So for weight loss, the plant-based diet for many people provides almost an automatic weight loss, and they still get to feel full. So that's the calorie density. You don't need to get in that many calories in order to feel full. Nutrient density, on the other hand, is how many nutrients are there per calorie. So the good thing about a plant-based diet is that the foods tend to be very nutrient-dense, meaning you pack in a lot of nutrients, but they're not calorically dense. So a lot of nutrients in relatively few calories. And that's what we think makes this diet so great for athletes, for the recovery, because your body can basically get everything it needs to do their work of repairing and rebuilding muscle, in relatively few calories. So you can it can do this rather efficiently, get all kinds of anti-inflammatory compounds, antioxidants, and all these other micronutrients that are just packed into plant-based foods without a huge caloric load.
I appreciated a point in the book when you draw a comparison between a paleo diet and a vegan diet. Explain that relationship to us.
Yeah, basically, there are some similarities in the fact that we both focus on whole foods. But rather than eating animal protein, we go for the original source of nutrients, which is plants. That's where vitamins and minerals originate. That's where there are 64 times more antioxidants in plants than animal foods. It's the only place where fiber exists. I don't know if people know that. Fiber only exists in plants. And then, of course, a plant-based diet is void of dietary cholesterol. Dietary cholesterol only comes from animal protein. So those are some of the differences there. And we feel that a diet high in fiber and without the dietary cholesterol is one that's going to be just better for our heart, better for our overall health. And that translates to, actually, better overall athletic performance.
The book, again, is The Plant-Based Athlete, A Game-Changing Approach to Peak Performance, published by Harper One. Matt Frazier and Robert Cheek, thank you for giving the world this important book.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the time.
Bye-bye. Monday on The Morning Show, a rebroadcast of my memorable conversation with Matt Loglin, author of Two Kisses for Maddie, a memoir of loss and love. The loss represented the death of his beloved wife, Liz, just hours after she gave birth to their beautiful daughter, Madeline. This book has been transformed into a Netflix film called Fatherhood, starring Kevin Hart. And that's why we are rebroadcasting this conversation on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, as we approach the end of Pride Month, I'm rebroadcasting my conversation with AIDS activist Cleve Jones. It was his idea to create the Names Project AIDS Memorial Quilt, which is still growing and now numbers nearly 50,000 individual memorial panels. Next Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear will be back for his monthly visit to the program. Next Thursday, a look back at one of the most influential, groundbreaking television series of all time, Moonlighting. And a week from today, the author of The Bronx Zoom, which looks at the New York Yankees and how they can